Welcome to PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast, where we use data, research, and conversation to reveal important trends and issues in the private markets.
Welcome, everyone, to the Invisible Capital Podcast. We're devoting Season 1 to examining the private markets by discussing the work of PitchBook analysts and writers during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Adley Bowden, head of our institutional research and news teams here at PitchBook. This episode is a bit of a special one, as we're going to be experimenting with a slightly different format. We recently hosted our 2Q 2020 Venture Monitor webinar, which was based on the Q2 2020 PitchBook NVCA Venture Monitor report done in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank and Certint. The webinar's conversation was so good, we thought we would test out a highlight show. The webinar included Bobby Franklin, President and CEO of the NVCA, Cameron Stanfill, a venture analyst at PitchBook, Jennifer Friel Goldstein, Head of Business Development, Technology, and Healthcare at Silicon Valley Bank, and Matthew Lee, a product manager for Certint. It was moderated by Lee Gibbs from PitchBook. Before we get into the highlights, a quick recap of the second quarter, which was about as unique of a quarter as they come for the U.S. venture capital industry. The coronavirus certainly impacted all facets. Much of the slowdown occurred during the early part of the quarter, when uncertainty over COVID-19's impact on the economy was at its height. After the initial month and a half of exercising caution, triaging, and focusing primarily on stabilizing their own portfolio companies, VC investing began to pick up in May. In fact, U.S. venture capital investment totaled $34.3 billion during the quarter, which is in line with 1Q's totals and very similar to the quarterly amounts we have seen over the last couple of years. However, the count of deals did drop by just over 20%. Exit totals suffered significantly, with only 147 completed, most of which were certainly underway ahead of the pandemic. Venture capital funds actually did all right. In fact, as of July 1st, 148 funds have been raised, totaling $42.7 billion of capital, though the majority of that capital was certainly also committed pre-pandemic. Now to the webinar. A big contributor to the decline in deal flow was a drop in early stage deals, which were challenged by the need for investors and founders to adapt to remote due diligence and investment meetings. Here's our analyst Cameron and Jennifer from SVB providing some commentary on this challenge and what to expect in the second half of the year.
I think obviously at the end of the day, like investors, they have to look at new deals. Some have been, I think, a little bit more reticent to do all, kind of virtual like Zoom deals. I think we're hearing some of that. And then I think there's another camp of people that I think is growing now that it's been kind of extending for such a long period in the work from home setting that, you know, they've kind of reevaluated the timelines and are realizing that to do new deals, they're going to have to get comfort, I think, over virtual kind of Zoom meetings. And so obviously they're looking for the same information. They're looking to still build trust kind of with the founders. I think, you know, that's becoming maybe difficult and you're going to have to do it in another way. But I think they're also some benefits that I think we're hearing about. You know, you're able to sit in on other meetings, you're able to not travel to go see other people, so you're saving time. You know, anecdotally, I think some people are saying that this makes due diligence processes a little bit quicker for them because they're not traveling or spending like an extended period of time on a site visit. They're, you know, getting a virtual site visit or something like that. So I think potentially that leads to saying no quicker as well. Like if you can have a Zoom meeting the next day and you realize you're out, like you're maybe saying no quicker to a lot of deals. But I think people are finding a way and making a way that you still build that relationship. You can still build the trust with the, you know, with the company itself, even when it is all via Zoom.
Well, and that actually might be a good segue back to Jennifer. If I can actually quote you from the Venture Monitor, you said that investors and entrepreneurs are getting creative with new ways to get to know one another in this environment. Can you expand upon what you were getting at there and what you're seeing?
It was a point in time comment, but I think it's really held up. When we first went into shelter in place, a lot of VCs were, as Cameron mentioned, pretty reluctant to start a brand new investment with founders that they've never interacted with in person at all. So it was someone they'd interacted with in the past, that was different. We saw a lot of those deals sort of being prioritized, but new, never met the team, never done a site visit. People were pretty reluctant in that March, April timeframe. as many of the attendees are pointing out in the chat and in the Q&A, the pipeline can't last forever of people you've already met. So sure. VCs needed to start to innovate, to think about, well, how am I going to get over this historic need to meet someone in person to get a good sense of who they are? And we started to see the introduction of the socially distanced walk, the cocktail hour, or let's do a cooking class with these potential entrepreneurs, just to try to replicate some of the non-meeting presentation PowerPoint types of interactions, which is the piece that I think a lot of the investors were trying to pick up on. And we've also definitely seen an increase pretty much across the board in background checks and reference checks. So in a way, it's democratized a little bit the idea that you can get good information about someone from a variety of sources and not just your gut check of meeting them in person. I actually think that bodes very well for something that I know we're going to talk about a little later, but you know, increased transparency and diversity in terms of how are you actually making a qualitative decision about a founder. I think, you know, opening up more creative ideas for how you get to know somebody is a great first step, actually, in being more open-minded about assessing that hard to capture element of meeting somebody in person that we used to rely on in the past.
Healthcare was one area with a lot of activity during Q2 on the investment side. Here's Jennifer's take on how much of this is a short-term pandemic-related phenomena and how much of it is part of a long-term investment cycle.
I would say if you take a look at some of the statistics there and just qualitatively what we've seen, there has been a tremendous amount of excitement about investing in healthcare broadly over an extended period of time. So there's a lot of focus on healthcare and biotech in particular in 2020 because of the public market activity. But this is not a new trend. This is something that has been robust and growing over the last several years. So certainly the immediate need for increased innovation in COVID and vaccine related technology. This is not just for vaccination. I should point out there's also a lot of therapeutic development and diagnostic development and tracing and digital health related to COVID. But the vast majority of the activity that we've seen is not related to the pandemic. So while many companies have added an element of their research to include some COVID-related exploration, I would say that the vast majority of the investment that we've seen is just continuing this trend that started in late 2017, certainly through 2018 and 2019, of a very robust healthcare investment cycle.
There were several audience questions about what types of companies were getting funded in this environment, and I thought Matt from Certain had an interesting answer to a question about the traits of companies that are inspiring confidence and able to attract investors' attention.
Really, the concept of proof of traction comes into play. I neglected to say the flip side of that is there's a lot of companies out there that if they don't have any semblance of traction, they're having a hard time getting the funding. So, but on the really resilient side, it's really those founders that I'm seeing that, you know, are very creative, and they're very open about their position, where they are, and they're quite frank with themselves. And I think that instills a lot of confidence in just who they are as an individual, and helps build on that qualitative aspect that's important. Specifically, some of those founders are the ones that are just concentrated on their war chest, their team, and really just trying to think about what are those situations, how can we actually work with our investors in a creative way that makes sense for us as a potential going concern and for the investors themselves.
With his viewpoint on equity management for Certain, Matt also highlighted a few ways in which companies have adapted their equity practices with employees and investors to the current environment.
I think what we're seeing a lot of is the companies that we're working with, they're definitely not looking for one solution to fit all their problems. They're taking a multi-pronged approach typically. And it generally kind of boils down to a couple of specific strategies, at least that I've seen. And one of them is really just, you know, the focus around, you know, the tough conversation of, you know, how do we, one, maintain our staff levels too? And then if we need to adjust our staff levels, what does that look like? So we have seen a lot of our clients that have had to adjust their employee base. They've taken a creative approach to how they're looking at their grant awards. And specifically, we've seen a huge uptick in furloughed agreements where employees can still maintain their shares if they come back after COVID kind of subsides. So there's definitely that. That's that aspect of it's been really creative and really interesting and promising to see. For some of the companies that are still raising or going through a funding cycle, we've seen a couple companies really increase the use of warrants as part of their offerings as well to investors to help continue to entice them and make sure those interests are consistent over the long term. And finally, from a different perspective, it's just I have seen quite a bit of deal velocity on the debt fund side, on the small side, come in as well. So there are some companies that are looking to raise some debt direct through some funds. They're not looking for a full 12 months, 18 months, but they are looking for a little bit of a bridge, if you will, to help them out through the short term.
There was one potential upside to our new remote world that was raised by Cameron that I thought was pretty interesting. And that is that as investors get used to remote investing, it could open up opportunities for companies located outside of the typical venture hubs.
I'm obviously optimistic about what this kind of, you know, work from home situation and how much that's advanced and kind of sped up the timeline of when working remotely works out for people and you can be as productive or more remotely. So I think that is potentially going to democratize, you know, the location of where, you know, companies are formed versus where their investors are. So I think right now in a lot of small places like that, the investor base is local, and especially for the first couple of rounds until they get, you know, big enough to attract attention. So I think the potential now is that you could be an investor sitting in Silicon Valley or New York or Boston and, you know, take meetings for companies that are, you know, located anywhere across the US or potentially internationally. So I think from that standpoint, you know, the funnel might get a little too big and so you can't take all those meetings, but the potential is there at least. There's no barrier anymore to flying to, you know, Austin or somewhere in Ohio or something like that to do a deal. You can just jump on Zoom like we are now and talk to that company.
Given the unprecedented economic and political environment the United States is in, the National Venture Capital Association has been busy working on the industry's behalf. As just one of many examples, here's a quick clip of Bobby Franklin covering some bipartisan legislation that the organization has recently been involved in.
First, I want to talk just a little bit about what we are looking at in terms of Washington and the fourth potential stimulus package that everybody's waiting on before Congress goes out for their traditional August recess. There's sort of three things we're looking at. First of all, a reboot of the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, and what changes there might be in store. As many of you will recall, when the first PPP went through with the CARES Act, there were a lot of questions about whether or not a venture-backed, equity-backed company would even be eligible to participate. And certainly it wasn't something for all venture-backed companies, but there are some that it was very important to. So we will be watching that. A second area you may have heard something about recently, in fact, it was in the news a little bit today, is the employee retention credit. When the first CARES Act went through, this is something that not many people paid attention to. But now that we have a HEROES Act introduced by the Democrats and a HEALS Act introduced by the Republicans, the numbers that they're talking about in this employee retention credit have grown significantly. We're talking up to $36,000 in one case, $30,000 in another. But it is based on revenue dropping. And once again, this is an area we have to continue to educate policymakers in Washington about the differences in established companies and looking at whether revenue drops and how a startup company where you're looking at a growth scale and it's not so much revenue dropping, they're just in a different stage of their life cycle. So we'll be watching this one. And given the fact that it's so difficult to get policymakers to understand the difference, we're also thrilled about a new bill that's been introduced that we had a little something to do with. It's a bipartisan bill. Representatives Dean Phillips, a Democrat from Minnesota, and Jackie Walorski, a Republican from Indiana, had put together, and this is what we call our tax assets proposal. The official name is the Ignite American Innovation Act, but the idea here is to recognize that startup companies, which are mostly in a loss position from a taxpaying position, have a lot of net operating losses and carry forwards on the books. They're also interested in R&D tax credits, whereas other countries make those refundable. We don't here in the U.S. And so the idea here is, how can we immediately help some of these startup companies? And how can we even have a bit of a bonus for those companies that are actually looking to solve issues for all of us around the world during this COVID-19 crisis? So those that are looking to make sure they provide solutions to us, they ought to get a little bonus. This basically would allow companies with less than 1,500 employees to monetize up to $25 million in net operating losses, carry forwards, and R&D credits. So we're hopeful that this can be included, and we'll be working on that. A second issue I want to bring up briefly is just the benefit that we have provided to the industry, particularly those that are in the middle of the country, and that is the years of work we put into modifying the so-called Volcker Rule to make sure that banks could once again be limited partners in these sorts of issues. And we are thrilled that the interagency group that we wrote many letters to and we had many in-person meetings has now decided to make that change. And that'll go into effect October 1st. We think this will help capital formation in parts of the country where they don't have as much capital for the entrepreneurs. And we're excited to see that happen. And lastly, I would just mention that we at NVCA are getting ready for the election, like a lot of folks. We will be prepared no matter what happens. Obviously, if President Trump gets reelected, we'll continue to work on deregulation issues like the Registered Investment Advisor Act and what that definition looks like. Obviously, that means we're going to have a harder time getting immigration through. On the flip side, if Senator Biden or Vice President Biden gets elected, then we're going to really push immigration changes that would be so helpful to us. We'll push things like basic research, but we know we'll have a challenge when it comes to tax issues like the overall capital gains rate and whether there's a differential between capital gains and ordinary income, which we know helps lead to long-term capital formation. So I just wanted you to know that we are thinking about what will happen in November, and we're being ready and getting prepared no matter what happens.
Jumping now to the exit environment for VC-backed companies, Jennifer covered what to expect and look for in terms of corporate acquisitions.
If you think about what the vast majority of investors were focused on in April and May, it was shoring up their portfolios. Most of the solid companies have found ways, either through top-up rounds, venture debt, a reduction in force, as Matt talked about, or other cost-cutting measures, to get themselves to 12 to 18 months of cash. I think we've seen that pretty universally across a lot of the well-funded VC firms being able to help the vast majority of their portfolio companies have that type of runway. And so they aren't really backed up against a corner yet in terms of needing to take a massive down round valuation, which is some of the questions in both the chat box and the Q&A here have been about why haven't valuations dropped so much. Same with M&A. I mean, a lot of these companies are not yet forced to take an M&A transaction that is not at the valuation or exit comps that they are hoping for. That may change, to Cameron's point, over the next couple of quarters. I think when we get into Q2, of 2021, we will really have to see which of these companies are going to be able to cut, top up, or extend their runway beyond what they've already done in this first pass effort. And some of those companies may be acquisition targets, even if they're not excited about it. And so we've definitely heard an increase in appetite from a lot of the big corporate acquirers. When we talk to our friends at law firms, there is a lot of exploration being done about transactions. But I think until the fundamental economics are such that the seller, in this case, the company, or the investors who sit on those boards, really need to be strategic about taking some less than desirable economics on an exit, we won't see that big, giant flurry of activity probably for another quarter or two, would be my best estimate.
In the public markets, SPACs have been a recent hot topic. So here's Cameron with details on what these are and the benefits they offer.
And Cam, many companies and their investors have kind of been deterred from IPOs as an exit route, right? Not really surprising, as public markets have shown pretty considerable volatility. But as a result, we've seen an uptick in the use of special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs. Can you briefly unpack what these are and touch on their usefulness in this scenario?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's been probably one of the hotter topics within kind of the finance space during the whole crisis. So it's definitely interesting to see, obviously, innovation just around the process of going public anyway, for startups in particular as well. I think it's well known that it's a very expensive process. And while the SPAC adds some extra structure, by going public via reverse merger, and the cost aspect is kind of up in the air, depending on if it is actually, you know, a better deal for the company itself that becomes public through the SPAC than an IPO on the cost side. It is obviously better from a time perspective that the company has to spend not going on a roadshow or preparing itself in other ways to prepare for an IPO. So I think there's definitely some good things that are coming out of these becoming a little bit more popular. I think for VC-backed companies in general, I think one, scalability, I think is an issue with SPACs in general, that they're mainly, doing one deal, and you have to rely on sponsors going out and raising new SPACs for them to be able to go acquire more companies. And so, I don't think it's going to be a, end-all solution for any, startup that wants to go public, because I think there's only a certain number of, institutions out there or folks that can go out and raise these SPACs to do deals like this. So I think that's one thing on kind of a bit of a tapping the brakes on the hype around what they could do for VC-backed companies. I think for, a company that fits the mold, like maybe very capital intensive, needs to raise a lot of capital, potentially needs kind of a shift in strategy, a little bit more input. I think there's definitely some benefits that maybe you couldn't go public via an IPO, but you can from a SPAC. So I think that's obviously a good thing. More companies becoming public, accessing public capital markets via either debt or equity. I think there's also potential for VC firms to be a little bit more targeted and offer a new service via a SPAC. So if a VC firm itself can raise a SPAC and either help take another private company public that maybe they don't have a relationship with, or that they wanted to invest in, but they haven't been able to in the private markets, maybe raise a SPAC and be able to do that deal. So I think there's going to be some creative ways, I think, that people in the private markets go about maybe doing interesting structures with these deals and kind of, making the public markets a bit more accessible. So I think for the most part, obviously, it's a good thing, more capital potentially for companies. So it's a very interesting time, and I'm glad to see it happening now that there's a bit of that uncertainty in the public markets, and these can maybe provide some stability for companies that want to go public still.
Moving on to the topic of fundraising for venture capital funds, Lee and Cameron provide an overview of what the market looks like currently and the trends around mega funds.
I do want to come full circle and discuss the fundraising landscape, beginning with the fact that, the top 15 funds raised in H1 2020 here came to a total of $22.7 billion, making up over half of all VC fundraising in the year so far. All in all, VC mega funds have been pretty prolific thus far, with 24 of them closing in 2020. Cam, you wrote, obviously, there was a momentum of these funds, from 2019, as much of the work was completed then, to get these fundraised complete. But I'm just curious your take on how much of the fundraising that we're seeing is about a tailwind from 2019 versus people seeing opportunity in the post-pandemic era that is to come?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot, obviously, of those largest funds were definitely started probably before the pandemic really took hold, I think, in the United States. And so there's definitely a lot of them, I'm sure, that already had quite a few kind of intent, allocations from LPs. And so I think that definitely helps. Maybe if you already have, about like 75% of the fund raised or something like that, like getting that over the edge kind of in 2020, I think was doable, at least. Like, I think there was momentum behind that. I think another reason that those huge funds had success is they're huge for a reason. I think like they've displayed performance over the last, decade plus of, funds that they've raised. And so I think the popularity of getting into funds like that because of the returns that the returns potential, I think there was people who maybe didn't have opportunities to invest in, some of those firms' previous funds, and then were now presented with the opportunity because, maybe they were searching a little bit wider to fill out that last bit of a fund. So I think there was that for the very, what you would think of as like top tier managers who have, been in the top quartile for performance, I think there's hot enough fundraises that they were able to find demand, even if they did have to maybe search a little wider than their normal, fundraising process. So, I think the timelines may extend for funds to raise their target amount of capital, but for the most part, it seems like there's still enough institutional investors that want the returns that VC can provide, especially in a zero interest rate environment that we seem to be in for the long haul. So I think there's still going to be that demand for getting into those, especially very prominent type huge VC funds.
We did see during the quarter a significant drop in fundraising activity by smaller funds, particularly those being raised by first-time fund managers. Despite this, Jennifer is optimistic things will improve and highlights their importance to the innovation ecosystem.
I certainly see a place and a critical need for the innovation economy to support emerging managers, whether these are first-time investors raising their first fund or these are well-established GPs breaking away from some of the mega funds to start a smaller, more focused effort, whether that be by sector or geography or something. We see a lot of that activity too. Will they tap some of the traditional LPs who are backing the bets that Cameron just talked about, the pension plans, the endowments? Maybe not. I think that the sources of capital for an emerging manager look a little different in terms of where they typically raise money, whether that be from corporates or family offices, or as I talked about earlier, maybe even the mega funds themselves as they start to deal with their own pipeline visibility into some of these smaller, interesting companies that these mega funds, as again I mentioned, just don't really have the capability of doing a lot of seed stage and early stage investing themselves. So what I love most about our emerging managers, and we have an entire team dedicated to supporting them, is they're scrappy, right? They're going to go out there. They're going to find a way if they're really passionate about what they do. They're also generally really exceptional at what they do. They have some sort of expertise that makes them uniquely qualified to be investing in the sector or the geo or the business models that they've decided to create a fund around. And the industry needs that. So we will do all we can to play matchmaker and help those firms be successful. But I think the innovation economy doesn't function without them. So while it's very hard right now as a brand new emerging manager to go out and probably get traditional LP attention, we are finding that good emerging managers are still managing to close new funds in this environment, albeit maybe with a more diverse set of capital partners.
The webinar concluded with the question of what the panelists are optimistic about moving forward. Here are their answers in the order of Jennifer, Cameron, and Matt.
I was so happy to see Bobby kick us off this morning because we've partnered with the MVCA on a new initiative I'm pretty excited about called Venture Forward, which is about increasing diversity and inclusion in the investor landscape. And I think there is so much momentum and earnest desire to finally bring about long overdue change to who is actually making capital allocation decisions for the companies that are solving the world's biggest problems. And I'm just a really big believer that we need voices from all over the country, all over the world, from all different backgrounds, from all different perspectives, in order to tackle the types of problems we are now as a society faced with. And so my big optimistic takeaway right now is that I think there is solid momentum building to bring true diversity into the VC landscape. And I'm just super excited to partner with the MBCA on this.
When things change in the world, I think there's an opportunity for companies, especially like agile young companies, to take more market share and produce something great that does really solve, you know, problems that we have as, you know, a world, or, you know, just as a certain, you know, business model or something like that, a problem that needs to be solved. So I think the opportunities that arise because of crises are something that startups, I think, can capitalize on. And so I think there's a lot of optimism for me as far as the companies that get formed during times like this, or the companies that, you know, really shine during a time like this and grow after.
I think from my perspective, and what I'm most optimistic about is really just, you know, the concept of remoteness and being a digital nomad, being forced to work home and work remotely, I think is starting to ease a lot of folks' concerns about how do we effectively produce as an organization without being shoulder to shoulder with each other in an office. And so I'm really hoping that this trend will continue, whether it's flexible work arrangements or just the ability to work remote in general. You know, I think that's going to open up organizations' talent pools in a way that they might not have considered before. So I'm quite optimistic about that.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast. Please let us know what you think of this format. You can find us on Twitter at PitchBook News, or myself on Twitter at Adley B. You can find the show notes along with the links to the full report and a recording of this webinar at pitchbook.com/podcast.